the Christian faith is not something on the surface of a man's life.
It's not like a veneer or a finish on the outside. Instead, it's something that happens within us, in the very center of a person. And that is why the New Testament talks about rebirth, talks about being born again, talks about new creation and receiving a new nature within us. It's something that happens in a person in the very center of their being. The Beatitudes are a description of this newness that's in us, that has been put into us, and it's essentially who we are to be. You see, a Christ follower is something before he does something. And you have to be a Christ follower before you can act as a Christ follower. There is a change, there is a shift. And as we've been talking about this, the Sermon on the Mount is a vision and picture that Jesus gave of what Christ followers should be like. And what we and it's for them to live out. This isn't a picture of the way the world is supposed to be. This is the way followers of Christ are supposed to be. So when we look at the Beatitudes, it's as if we're being examined by these words of Jesus, as if we're being subjected to searching and testing. And I don't know, maybe it's like for some of you have a picture of yourself once upon a time when you're fit and trim, and you look at that and go, don't look like that anymore, do I? And sometimes it makes you feel like, ew, but other times it motivates you and you want to, you know, get in shape or whatever, you know? Well, this is the picture that Christ gave of what his people are to look like. And they tell us, and this picture really tells us where we stand, you know? And sometimes that may be uncomfortable. You know, if I look at the words of Jesus and I start getting impatient with those words and I dislike the probing and the testing of Jesus' words, then I can probably know that I'm not aligned with him. And my position is probably contrary to his vision of the Christian life. But on the other hand, if I do recognize that Jesus' words, they do search me, and sometimes they hurt me, but that they're essentially good for me, and that they are a mirror that shows me who I really am in the light of God's pattern, then there's hope for me and my condition and my state of being. So sometimes, like last week, I threw out something there. I said, in regards to poor in spirit, that there's this thing that our culture has accepted, you know, believe in yourself. I said, nowhere in the Bible does it say believe in yourself. Jesus didn't tell you to do that with yourself. He said, deny yourself. And I told you for some homework. I hope you did it. I hope if you didn't know it, look up the second greatest command. It says, love your neighbor as yourself. So we're to be loving ourselves. And that's not a narcissistic type thing. You know, but there's a difference between a biblical love and this kind of pseudo love of the world. A biblical love is being patient, being kind, forgiving. And so are you kind with yourself? Are you loving yourself? Are you forgiving of yourself? So it's not a believe in yourself. It's different. It's different. So sometimes those words of Jesus and the Beatitudes, being poor in spirit, I'm happy if I'm empty. I mean, that just doesn't make sense in our culture. And so it confronts us, and it's kind of like, wow, what do I do with that? But I want to encourage you, don't run away from those words. Because, you know, some of us here, you know, have this desire. We say we want to be spiritual people. We want to be Christ-like. Well, if you want that, if you really want that, you're just not saying it. You're just not trying to fit in with Asheville and the whole I'm a spiritual person kind of thing. If you really want that, these are the words of Jesus. And this is what he says, that if you want to be spiritual, this is it. Be these things. Not just do these things, but be these things. Become this. All right? And I know that last week, in the first four Beatitudes, a lot of that I feel like can be summed up in the words of John the Baptist when he looked at Jesus and he said, I must become less and he must become greater. And really, that's kind of the prayer when you start with the first four Beatitudes and you look at Jesus and you look at yourself. You look at him, and how do I become poor in spirit? I look at him and I say, I am in need He is so spiritually rich, but I am so spiritually empty. I am bankrupt spiritually. So again, we look at him, and it's this pattern of, Lord, less of me, more of you. And so sometimes that confronts our culture that says so much about ourself and what we're supposed to do with ourself. So, but in picking up where we left off last week, we ended with, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And it really marks a transition into the next four Beatitudes, which start looking at not just ourself in relation to God and our disposition with God and the attitude we have with God, but begins looking at our attitude with others and how our relationship with God changes that attitude and our disposition. So, blessed are the merciful is what next. And these Beatitudes, again, blessed, another way we translate that today in our language would be happy. Happy are the merciful. So the Beatitudes are qualities that we're to possess as Christ followers. They're a picture of who we're to be. And the possession of these qualities makes a person blessed or happy. All right? So here we go. Happy are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. All right, now merciful doesn't mean easygoing. Doesn't mean not to see things. Or if we do see things, well, pretend like we didn't see them. It's not an overlooking kind of thing. You've got to know that merciful is also a word that's used to describe God's character. And God is merciful, but yet at the same time, he is righteous, just, and holy. And it's something he possesses, but gives at the same time of being these things. God hasn't overlooked wrongdoing and sin. He just made a way to forgive it. Right? Grace has to do with something undeserved. Grace is forgiveness of sin, and it's the gift of life. Mercy has to do with suspending punishment. It's also something we don't deserve. Mercy has to do with suspending punishment and also acting to relieve suffering. That's what mercy is. You know, a really good picture of mercy can be seen in the story that Jesus told of the Good Samaritan. And if you know some things about Bible history and the Jews and the Samaritans were a people that were ostracized by the Jews. They were shunned and pushed away because at one time they were fellow Jews, but then they married outside of the Jewish race, which was forbidden by God. And when they did that, they started serving the gods of the foreign people that they married, and then they just started walking away from the ways of God totally, where they didn't even look like God's people. And so those who were faithful Jews shunned them, and the Samaritans all settled in one area. And it was kind of like a territory or a district like we would have in our country, like the District of Columbia. And so if you're a good Jew, or you know, if you're a good Jewish boy, good Jewish girl, you would avoid Samaritans. You would not associate with them. And if you had to travel to get from one place that was on the other side of their district, you would go around that district. You wouldn't go through it, even if it meant it was going to be miles out of your way. So they would do this all the time. And the Samaritans, they felt hurt by this. They felt ostracized by their half-brother Jews. But when this story comes along, Jesus says that there's a Jewish businessman. And he finds himself beaten and left for dead alongside the highway. And there's several Jewish brothers that walk by and ignore him. But it's not a fellow Jew that comes to his aid. It's a Samaritan, an enemy, who sees him and takes pity on him. And he takes care of his wounds. He bandages him up. He takes him to a safe place. He pays for his room and board. And the Samaritan could have, when he saw that beat up Jew laying on the side of the road, he could have said and could have rightly thought in his head, this is someone who belongs to those people who hate me. This person belongs to the people who have banished and excluded my people. Someone who would rather see me dead than alive. And this man, he's just getting what he deserves. So I'm going to leave him for dead. He could have rightfully thought that in his head. Probably would have been just. But instead, the Samaritan, he had the power. The power was within his hands to rescue this Jew and out of his suffering and misery. And that's what he did. He took pity and action and put them together to show mercy. Show mercy. So if you're a Christ follower and you've experienced this new birth, this turning upside down of your life, then you recognize that at one time before you came to Christ, that you were an enemy of God once. You see, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we were still His enemies, He came to make peace with us. We deserved to be left for dead. But the Lord has shown us mercy. You see, you and I, we recognize that we deserved punishment, but instead, God has shown us mercy through Christ. The forgiveness we receive is entirely based on God's mercy and grace. And if I have experienced that, then doesn't it seem to follow that my attitude towards everybody else must be completely, entirely changed? It should be. You and I should see everyone who's in the state of sin as someone who's to be pitied, just like we once were. And if I truly realize my position before God and that I'm forgiven in that way, then out of necessity, I'm going to forgive those who sin against me. You have seen what God has done for you in spite of what you deserve, and you say, I know that I am truly forgiven, therefore I truly. How do you become merciful to others? You look at Jesus. You look at Jesus. Look at the one who, while being nailed to the cross, showed mercy upon his executioners and said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Forgive them. Look at Jesus. And if you realize that you're not merciful, then you need to go back to that first beatitude. Realize where you came from. That you were once poor in spirit, spiritually bankrupt. And you need to get back to that place saying, I'm still needy, Lord. I still need you. I still need your mercy. I still need your grace just as much as anybody else. So what makes us merciful is the grace of God. And have you experienced that grace? Happy are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. The next thing that Jesus says in this spiritual sequence of the Beatitudes, he says, blessed or happy are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. You know, the gospel always is concerned with the heart. And Jesus is always talking about the heart. Even in the Sermon on the Mount, the heart is the center of the teaching. And we'll see more of that next week as we look into it. In the Jewish world, the heart was the center of man's being and personality, and it included the mind, the will, and the seat of the emotions. It was the fountain of a person's life. It's the source from which everything flowed. But the heart was also viewed as the seat of all our troubles. It's where troubles come from, too. Jesus spoke of how out of the heart comes evil thoughts and a list of other bad things he goes on to mention in Matthew 15, 19. You see, our world thinks that man is basically good, and it's just our environment and our society that is an evil structure and therefore makes man do bad things and makes us bad. And so people think in our country and other places around the world, if we perfect our society, if we perfect our environment, then man will not be bad. But the Jewish and biblical thought never overlooks the fact that it was in paradise that man fell. It was in a perfect environment that man first went wrong. It's not to say that we don't try to fix those societal structures that are broken. Like last week when we heard about Sunil in India and the caste system that's been just an evil oppression for 3,000 years. It's not to say that we don't oppose that and try to change that. But we don't put all our hope in that. See, the real problem lies within the heart of people. And God is concerned with our hearts, the center of our beings. See, to be pure in heart means to be cleansed or without defilement. But it also means singleness. You know, pure gold is just one thing. It's gold. There's nothing else in it. There's no flakes of iron, steel, or mica, or nickel, any other kind of metal. It's not in there. If it's pure gold, it's only one thing. It's single. There's no impurities in it. Pure can also mean without folds and layers. And like this little piece of paper that's folded up into layers, there's layers here and things that can hide within the folds. But to be pure of heart would to unfold these pleats, unfold these things, and to become one layer, not multiple layers. That would be pure, pure in heart, one, single, without folds. It means I open up, I remove the layers and folds, so there's just one layer, an undivided heart, open before God. The psalmist wrote about this. He said, "Give me an undivided heart that I may fear your name." He's asking God to start with the source of all his trouble, a divided heart. He asked God to unite his heart, to take out the pleats, to take out the folds and the mixing of things and let it be whole, one, set upon one single focus. You see, pure in heart is an unmixed condition of being. Do you know God is like that? God says that he is light, and in him there is no darkness. He's not a mix of light and darkness, only light. And there is no mixing of God with some other false god, whether it's a god of some earth religion, or god of wealth, or god of self. And we have got to be pure in heart to see God, because he is pure. But the problem is that we can't make ourselves pure of heart. That's a frustrating place to be in, to recognize that you're not pure in heart and then go, how do I become pure in heart? Well, how do you do that? Well, look at Jesus and look at yourself. Look at the one who is focused on one thing, pleasing the Father. Look at the one who makes and gives new hearts. You know how he solves the problem of a heart that's impure? He says, "I'll take your heart of stone, and I'll give you a heart of flesh." Puts a new one in us, one that never existed before. And it makes it pure. He takes out the things that have divided. You see, the gospel of Jesus answers how this problem can be solved. It can't be done by self-cleansing. Any kind of attempts to self-cleanse yourself is just going to be a doomed failure. It won't work. You know, so many times I hear people talk to me about, you know, getting close to God or coming to church or however they want to phrase it. And they say, "Well, you know, there's a few things in my life I just need to get straight before I come to church. Or a few things in my life that I need to straighten out before I try to get close to God." It's like, no, you're missing the whole point. You're trying to, you got some little soap that you think you're going to clean yourself up with. And that's just a total insult to the cross of Christ. You can't do that. You come to Jesus with all your dirt, all your filth, and your impure heart, and you just lay it bare before him. And he takes care of cleaning up. And then you get close, you know? He says, "Come in close now. Come in close now with all your dirt, with all your impurities. Come close to me." And he can give you one heart. It's a fresh start. It's a new life. It's a new birth. It's a second chance. Like Paul, though, we get this new heart, this heart that's pure. And we realize, though, that we have a new inner being, but we still deal with the leftovers of our flesh and our sinful nature. So we join David in his prayer. We say, "Create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a right spirit within me." So again, this isn't just a one-time thing at conversion when we come to Christ. This is something we come before him and we look at him. Whether it be in your time of prayer in the morning or in the evening. And you just say, "Lord, make me poor in spirit. Make me mourn over my sin. Lord, help me to be meek. Help me to hunger and thirst. Help me to be merciful. And Lord, make me pure in heart. Give me an undivided heart, solely set on you." And the promise is that a heart made single and focused will see God. You'll see God. You'll see him in nature. You'll see him in the events of history. You'll see him in the sense of knowing him and sensing that he is near and enjoying his presence. And one day, you're going to see him face to face. It's not going to be through something, but you're going to see him face to face. And you are being prepared from this day forward to enter into the presence of the King of Kings. Happy are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Well, in Jesus' sermon, the next thing that he shares is, "Blessed or happy are the peacemakers, for they'll be called the sons of God. A peacemaker is a person who has peace, but also produces peace and does all he can to maintain that peace. A peacemaker is not someone who avoids trouble at any cost, nor are they appeasers and do unjust or unrighteous things to avoid conflict. A peacemaker is not content to let sleeping dogs lie, nor is he or she concerned about maintaining status quo. Ultimately, a peacemaker is concerned with the need for all people to be at peace with God. That's his ultimate concern. He or she is a person who will go out of their way or even go through conflict to produce peace. So what is this biblical peace that sons and daughters of God are trying to produce and maintain? Well, it's more than a cessation or absence of conflict. It's more than that. The scriptures define it more as wholeness or even salvation. The Hebrew concept of peace, shalom, refers to the state of well-being, wholeness and harmony that infuses all of one's relationships. Biblical peace is rarely spoken of as some purely mental state, as serenity or peace of mind. Peace isn't confined to one's psyche. Instead, peace is a way of life. It's a way of walking. Scriptures speak more than once about the way of peace and that we're supposed to be walking in that. And that way of peace, that wholeness, is to be in all our relationships and the people that we walk with. And establishing and sustaining wholeness in all our relationships is no easy thing. It is not easy, folks, is it? I know some of you here that are struggling with relationships with family members or extended family members. You know, to be in right relationship with God and one's fellow creatures, one must consistently do what is right, what God desires and what God requires. You know, shalom can only be established and sustained by God. That peace can only be, we are incapable of securing that peace ourselves. The rule and reign of Jesus inaugurates peace or wholeness in our lives. Jesus is our peace. He is our peace. And God's reconciling work brings us peace, which enables us to live righteously before God and at peace with one another. You see, peacemakers are those who are imitating Jesus' way of life and those who are bringing a fragmented life together. You see, we live in a very fragmented world, a world in pieces. The people we live near are rarely the people with whom we work. And the people that we work with are the people we rarely play with. And often, none of those people are the people with whom we worship. We have these separate little worlds, and we go to each one. And sometimes, there's a little problem that happens with that. We kind of take on different roles, or we act like a different person in each of those places, in each of those worlds. We telephone, we fax, we text, we email, and we have countless numbers of people with whom we remain all but anonymous to. They don't really know us. And the result is fragmentation, the disturbing sense that not only our lives, but also our very identities are fractured into scores of isolated, if not contradictory, fragments. So how do we bring those worlds together? How do we make it whole? How do we just be one person where everywhere we go? Nothing hidden. No pieces. It's a problem. Who am I when I gather with the body of Christ? Is that the real me? Is that the real you? Or is the real you somewhere with your buddies when you go out and go drinking? Or is the real you when you're hanging out with the folks at school and your professors, and you put on a different little look so that you can impress your teachers or whatever? Who am I when I gather with the body of Christ? Our world has been divided into a public and private life. And it's not the way it was in biblical times. And it's not the way it was maybe 60 years ago. But we've got this thing where we've split public and private life. And a little question like this can help you see this. On what basis do you determine what to purchase? Like, how many of us read certain books or watch certain movies or listen to certain music in the privacy of our own home, that we would not be comfortable reading, watching, or listening in the public company of our Christian friends. You see, there's been a division there that shouldn't be. It should be the same. We should be one wherever we go. We should not have a double life. How many students live one way at school, another way at home, and a third way at church on Sunday? As a peacemaker, you've got to reconcile these worlds into one world and live one way. You know your life can't be fragmented any longer, but must be made one. And that's one of the reasons I love See You at the Pole. Because it's a chance. It's a chance for students to identify themselves as peacemakers, identifying themselves as Christ followers on the school campus, and beginning that process of reconciling their private and public worlds. And people go, oh, you're a Christian. Are you one of those Christ followers, huh? And it's time for them to say, yep, I am. And I know maybe in the past, in the classroom, I haven't acted like it, but things are changing now. And those two worlds are colliding, or three worlds, or four worlds, or whatever it is. And if you haven't had that collision yet, it's going to happen. And at that moment, you'll be tested at what kind of peacemaker you're going to be. Are you going to reconcile those worlds and be one? And also, I love, you know, see what happens at See You at a Pole, because it's, again, it's a chance for students to identify themselves as ambassadors of Christ. Those who are ambassadors of the gospel, bringers of peace and peace with God. A peacemaker has to have a totally new life, a new view of life. And whether you're helping two friends reconcile, two races to reconcile, or a person to reconcile with God, you have to view yourself differently than you have before to be a peacemaker. To be one who makes peace, you have to have a new view of yourself. You have to have a new view of others, and you have to have a new view of the world. The view of yourself is that yourself is out of the view. That's the new view. You see, you're poor in spirit, mournful, meek, hungry for righteousness, merciful and pure in heart. And if you're always asking, hey, what about me? You're going to have trouble being a peacemaker. You'll never even see the other people around you or the world around you if you're always asking that question. Hey, what about me? See, you got to have a new view of yourself. The self has got to be out of the view. The new view of others is that you recognize people who are still being governed by the God of this world. You see, you don't have to ask, why are they like that? Why are they acting like that? You don't have to get all offended by people when they act like people of the world. And instead, you can start moving to a position of mercy and saying, you know what? I used to be like that. Yeah, I understand. Moving to a position of mercy and saying, wow, it's hard to live in the world like that, living to please so many people instead of just living to please one Lord. It's a crazy life. I know how it tears people apart. I know that sin destroys us. And you move to mercy instead of, oh, I'm so offended. I just don't even want to see that. Get that out of my face. The new view of the world is to see it through the lens of God's glory. You see, this world belongs to God. All people, all nations, all lands, all created things, and they were all made for His glory. When something goes wrong in this world, something is unjust or sinful is going on, that detracts. It detracts from God's glory. And that should concern us. See, God's glory is a peacemaker's concern. And so we war against the things that detract from God's glory. And we try to bring peace. You see, this kind of peace doesn't always mean the absence of conflict. It might mean that you have to go through conflict to bring this peace. So how do you be a peacemaker? You look at Jesus. You look at Jesus, the Prince of Peace, who went out of His way, went way out of His way, went out of heaven to earth, becoming a man to bring peace and reconcile us to God. Look at the one who had his view on God's glory and his view on you, who for the joy set before him and endured the cross, he thought of you and he thought of pleasing his Father and his glory instead of thinking of himself. And that's how he became Prince of Peace and a peacemaker. The last part of the Beatitudes, it simply explains what happens when you have all these qualities in your life. When you're poor in spirit, when you mourn, when you're meek, when you hunger and thirst, when you're merciful, when you're pure in heart, when you're a peacemaker, when you have these qualities in your life and expressed in your life, there's going to be two reactions from the world. And one reaction is going to be negative. The other reaction is positive. And the negative reaction is listed in the last two Beatitudes. Talks about, it's a reaction to righteousness and a reaction to being identified with Christ. And the positive response is Jesus describes in the conclusion of the Beatitudes. And Christ says this, "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me." Being persecuted isn't something that we strive for. It's something that just happens because we are like Christ. We've taken on his character. So, Jesus told his followers not to be surprised by this. He said, if you belong to another kingdom, people are going to think you're foreign. They're going to think you're strange. You're different. And know that if they hated me, then they're going to hate you. Jesus told us, don't be surprised by this. Now, don't be mistaken or get confused about this and think that, you know, if you're rude, harsh, boorish, selfish, jealous, stupid, and unkind, that the treatment you get for being that is somehow being persecuted for Jesus. It's not. You're being persecuted because you're being a jerk. You're being an idiot. Okay? That happens to people who are not Christ followers. They get made fun of and poked and all those jokes made fun of them because they're being idiots. Okay? So there's a difference between being an idiot and being persecuted for doing what's right, or being persecuted because you identified yourself as a Christ follower by your actions and your character. So don't confuse those things. It's not the same thing. And Jesus also explains that there's this other response that can happen when you have this Christ-like character. It's that people will encounter you like you are salt or like you're light. Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth," to those he envisioned becoming the embodiment of the Sermon on the Mount, these Beatitudes. You know, salt in the wound sometimes agitates. But what salt was known for and is still known for today is for bringing flavor and preserving. You know, Jesus said, "You are the one who brings out the God flavors to this bland earth." You're the one. You're the one to bring out the flavors. Someone who embodies the Beatitudes is one who will preserve the earth. You'll make it last. I truly believe that if Christ followers were not present on this planet, sin would just be ripping it apart. It would be falling apart. A songwriter once wrote about these people who embody Christ's character. He said, "You say that a man like that don't exist in a world like this. But I believe that the world won't last if a man like that don't exist." And I still believe that's true. You will be how some people taste genuine godliness. You'll be salt. Jesus also said that if you embody these qualities, that you're going to be like light, and people will experience the colors of God. Now, light doesn't have to be very large, doesn't have to be a spotlight to make a dent in the darkness. It can just be a very small light. And sometimes the problem that we have with light is that we sometimes do a light show with it. You know, we walk into a place, into a dark room with light. You know what happens with light in the morning? If someone comes in and flips on the bedroom light, like, "Oh, turn that off. My eyes aren't used to that." Well, sometimes that happens spiritually. You walk into the room with your light, and you're just being. You may not even said anything, done anything. People are kind of like, ooh, what is that? What is that? That hurts my eyes. And you go, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And you cover it up. And then you think it's safe to bring it back out again. You're like, oh, what is that? No, don't. Then, oh, I'm sorry. Cover it up. And what we do is do this on and off kind of thing. Kind of this, it's like a light show. And their eyes never get used to light because we're just blinding them. Off on, off on, off on. And the thing is that sometimes our trouble is that we're not consistent or that we don't have a place to stand with our light. Now, I put this down before in the first service. My wife was freaking out. She said, Chad, what are you doing? And she was scared it was going to roll off. And I suppose that light that's not in its place, you know, fire and it's not in its place can be kind of dangerous. But sometimes what we're looking for, what we need is just a place to stand. Jesus said that we're to take our light and put it in a place where it can give light for all to see. And so the light, we don't want to confuse the light with the stand. The stand might be what you do. The stand might be that student-led club on the school campus. It might be that something you do at your workplace. It's the stand. It's the place where you put your light. Your light is who you are. It's being the character of Christ. And so sometimes our struggle is just figuring out, where do I stand? Where I place? And that's something to pray about. Something that I pray for you. That you'll find your place to stand at workplace, in the school, on the campus, in your home, in your neighborhood. How can I shine? How can I best give light? I'm just going to be who I am. I'm not going to put on any airs. I'm not going to pretend. But how do I shine my light best for Christ? Lord, give me a place to stand. And you heard that in that one statement. The guy who talked about the lever. He said, give me a place to stand. I'll move the world. I think Jesus is thinking the same way with us. Just shine your light. I'll give you a place to stand. And I'll move the world. Impact the world.